For I know their works and their thoughts, the time is coming together all nations and tongues, and they shall come and see my glory. And I will set a sign among them, and will send survivors from them to the nations, to the distant coastlands, that neither heard my fame nor seen my glory. Again, Zechariah, you're going to go over it. Zechariah, Malachi, just before the end of the Old Testament. Zechariah 14, verse 16. Then it will come about in that day that all who are left of the nations that went up against Jerusalem will go up from year to year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to celebrate the Feast of Booths. So in the millennium, of course, there'll be Gentile nations, begun by those believing Gentiles who have come out of the tribulation period. And then through that thousand-year time period during the millennium, there will be those who are born in the millennium and not born again, not saved. Those will be the ones that down in Revelation chapter 20 we read then, that Satan, when he's released from the bottomless pit, that thousand-year imprisonment, comes out and deceives those who have not been saved in the millennium. And again, they gather the forces of around Jerusalem. The fire of God comes down from heaven, and eternity begins. The millennium's over. So Nebuchadnezzar fulfills a role for us in terms of what he typifies. There were three people 2 weeks ago asked me a question. That is, during the seven-year period that Nebuchadnezzar was wandering around the pasture, what happened to the administration in Babylon? So when three individuals asked me the same question, that must mean there are at least 30 people wondering what happened. So I gave the same answer to those three people. Now, in case you've been asking in your mind the same thing, just let me handle that very quickly. Turn back, if you will, to the book of Amos. And I want to show you what is said in the book of Amos, chapter 2, Hosea, Joel, Amos. Reference is made to God's protection of the Israelites when they left Egypt, in that he destroyed the Amorites before them. And look what God says about how he destroyed the Amorites just after the Exodus. Verse 9, chapter 2, in the book of Amos. Yet it was I who destroyed the Amorite before them. And now, watch what the reference is. Though his height was like the height of cedars. Again, a reference to a nation being like great trees. And he was strong as the oaks. I even destroyed his fruit above. Does that sound familiar? It sounds a little like Nebuchadnezzar's dream, doesn't it? And his root below. So, the fruit's destroyed, but God said, now with the Amorite, I destroyed the root too. I just took him out of the picture. But remember what was said in the book of Daniel in the dream. Now I'll go back to Daniel. And let's look in Daniel chapter 4 in the dream. In Daniel 4:15. Yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground. So as opposed to what God did to the Amorite when he destroyed the root, God says about this tree that represents Nebuchadnezzar, spare the root, and let's put a band around the stump. Let's protect the stump. And then when Daniel interprets that on over here in 26, he says, and in that it was commanded to leave the stump with the roots of the tree, your kingdom will be assured to you after you recognize it is heaven that rules. So during this seven-year period, God has already divinely ordained that Nebuchadnezzar's administration is going to be preserved. So it's not a question of what happened in Babylon during 7 years. It's the question of how well God protected the integrity of that administration. And apparently he did it quite well through vice presidents or whoever they were, and through his personal bodyguard who watched Nebuchadnezzar every day. And when he finally looked up at the end of 7 years and recovered his senses, his system was there, his organization was there for him to step back in and take over again. Because it was prophesied that that would happen. God divinely protected the system and administration that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So I think that's the answer, that God was in control sovereignly of the whole organization. Well, chapter 5, if you ever heard anyone say, I could see the handwriting on the wall. This is where it came from. This is the handwriting on the wall. And if you ever think, I'll never remember where that is. Just think, five fingers on your hand, and this is the handwriting on the wall, Daniel chapter 5. So you'll never forget where the handwriting on the wall is. So this is where it takes place, and this is where that saying came from. And isn't it interesting? In this small 12-chapter book of Daniel, we have more things in here that the world is familiar with than probably almost any other section of the Bible. I mean, who doesn't know about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the fiery furnace? I mean, everyone knows about that. Who doesn't know about the handwriting on the wall? And the very next chapter, who doesn't know about the lion's den? So you see, all these historic events have become just known by everyone, but they really are from the Word of God and are real events that happen in the lives of real people. Regardless of all his effort, regardless of the fact that he put his name, Nebuchadrezzar, as it really says, Nebuchadrezzar, on every brick 75 feet deep into his palace, he still died. Regardless of all his efforts to preserve himself and his kingdom, he still died. Regardless of the fact that he was probably one of the greatest kings and recognized by many as one of the greatest military men who's ever lived, certainly equal to Napoleon, he still died. One of the greatest builders, and he still died. And by the time he died, all that really was left was a deteriorating kingdom. And even though while he was alive, he was referred to by God as the head of gold. You are that head of gold, Nebuchadnezzar. The fineness of his kingdom, the finely tuned and finely honed administration of his kingdom, and the unity that he had in his kingdom, that's beginning to deteriorate and erode. When he died in 562, as you probably may see in that little chart that we handed out before, his son Amel-Marduk, called in the Bible evil, Evil-Marduk, took over as king, and we have a reference to him in the book of Jeremiah. So turn to Jeremiah chapter 52. Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel, two books back. And let's go to 52, verse 31. Now, you've got all your dates down by now, so you know what all these mean. Now, it came about in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the 12th month, on the 25th of the month, that Evil-Merodach, and if you have a marginal reference, you'll see they refer to him here as Awel-Marduk, king of Babylon, in the first year of his reign. Now, if you have the word first there in italics, that's probably not correct. This is probably the last year of his reign, when this took place, because he reigned from 562 to 560, according to the Babylonian chronicles, and he showed favor to Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and brought him out of prison. Now, the 37th year of his exile, when was he exiled? Remember that? 597, the second invasion. This is the 37th year, so when is that? About 560 B.C., and Evil-Merodach or Merodach reigned for 2 years, 3 years, from 562 to 560. So this is really the last year of his reign. And he takes this king and he brings him out of prison. And we read about what happened. He spoke kindly to him and he changed his prison clothes, had his meals in the king's presence regularly. So here's another historical event that we have in historical secular records also carried out in the Word of God. Well, he was murdered by his brother-in-law. Nice people. This was a mess going on here after the death of Nebuchadnezzar. He was murdered by his brother-in-law, Nergal-Sarsar, after he'd just been reigning there for about 2 or 3 years. And we have a reference to him, most commentators agree, back in chapter 39, from many years earlier during the captivity. It was about 26 years earlier. So go to Jeremiah 39. And we'll see this slight change in his name in the biblical record show up in chapter 39, verse 3. Then all the officials of the king of Babylon, that's about 588, by the way. Then all the officials of the king of Babylon came in and sat down at the middle gate. Nergal-Sarsar is there, you see. Now that is the one who later is going to assassinate Evil-Merodach. And on down in verse 13, and Nergal-Sarsar, the Rab-Mag, and that's an official title of a high officer. So he's one of the head men in Babylon. And after being involved with Jeremiah here, 26 years later, he's going to assassinate the king. And he's going to take over. He's going to rule for 4 years, till about 556. And then his son is going to take over. And his son is going to be assassinated the same year he takes over, in a military coup by a group of courtiers in the palace. And among that group of courtiers who assassinate him will be Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is probably married to Nebuchadnezzar's daughter, Nitocris. And that's where the little chain of events is going to come along. And then Nabonidus is going to have a son named Belshazzar, whose mother is Nitocris, the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So we have this continuation here from Nebuchadnezzar down to the events that begin to take place in Daniel chapter 5. So let's go back over there now to chapter 5, and we'll see what begins to happen. The year is 539. That's attested to not only in secular chronicles, but in the biblical record as well. So you can see Nebuchadnezzar died in 562. It's now 539. So we have about 23 years have gone by. Several kings have been on the throne. There have been assassinations and military coups and everything. And now Belshazzar is king. And we know from secular records that Nabonidus was a student. He was a scholar type monarch. He was not a military man. And in fact, he had a separate residence at Tema. He hadn't even been to Babylon for 14 years, the secular records tell him. And until several decades ago, skeptics used to laugh at Daniel chapter 5 because the secular record bore no evidence that a king named Belshazzar ever existed. They'd say, see, there's a mistake. The Bible's wrong. There was never a Belshazzar. And then just several decades ago, while the archaeologists were digging, they dug up a Persian verse account of Nabonidus, his personal records and chronicles. And in there, I quote, he said about his son Belshazzar, he freed his hand. He entrusted the kingship to him. Yeah, so all of the skeptics, then suddenly all of this doubt and ridicule just kind of fades away. No one ever mentions that, you see. So now, oh, well, I guess really there was someone, just like the Hittites. I guess there really was a Belshazzar. Sorry about that. So he was a real person. And Nabonidus is a man who did not want to be involved with Babylon. And he, as he said in his own words, Nabonidus said, he entrusted the kingdom to him. And he's out running around, okay, different places, digging up. He was an archaeologist in his own time. He was digging up ancient relics 2,500 years ago. Imagine that. He's a student, but he had nothing to do with Babylon. But remember that Herodotus, Xenophon, the Cyrus Cylinder, the Nabonidus Chronicles all attest to what's taking place in Daniel chapter 5, not just the Bible. So what you need to understand is that what's going on here didn't suddenly happen overnight. At this point in time in 539, the Babylonians had been at war with the Medes and the Persians for over 2 years. And the kingdom of Babylon was in serious, serious trouble. Just prior to these events here in chapter 5, Nabonidus had been fighting the Medes and the Persians with his army, had fled down to Babylon. He hadn't been there in 14 years. Because of the invading Medes and Persians, fled again and was captured by the Medes and the Persians in Sippor. So Nabonidus by this time has been captured already by the Medes and the Persians. And the Medes and the Persians are laying siege to the city of Babylon. So this doesn't take anyone by surprise. Okay, you know, when you first read this, they say, oh, I guess they were invisible people and suddenly they just happened to come there overnight. No, this had been going on for 2 years. So when you read this, you think, how foolish this is. We've got this huge army of the Medes and the Persians all out here around Babylon, and you've got this going on inside. They must be crazy. But you see, as Hosea says, much wine, and other things as well, pollute a person's thinking. There were a person living in sin has such a dark and clouded mind, we really don't see things in the proper perspective. And when you pick up the paper and you see where someone did just a foolish thing, you say, what's this crazy? Well, a person's mind becomes so clouded and so darkened by sin that reason escapes them. They do foolish things. Well, this is part of that, I think, right here. Chapter 5. Belshazzar the king held a great feast for 1,000 of his nobles, and he was drinking wine in the presence of his thousands. Why the feast? Probably to build morale. I'm sure morale was at an all-time low inside the city. The outlook was bleak. I think possibly Belshazzar believed that a feast like this on a very night of imminent danger would build up the morale of the people, would be a gesture of confidence. He may have planned to give a big speech that evening telling how the city could defend itself against the Medes and the Persians. And it was a great feast, he says. Now we know historical records verify that Alexander's marriage, which took place in Persia, had 10,000 guests. And archaeologists have uncovered one part of the ruins of Babylon, which is a large room with an alcove off one side of the room, which looks like the kind of place where the king would have his table. For all the others standing and everything could watch the king in that alcove. And some think it may be the very alcove because there's a plaster wall there where this event could have happened. Well, in Oriental custom, the king is to sit at a table before his guests. So the guests can kind of like a head table at a banquet. The guests can walk by, they can toast the king, and he's seated with this retinue there while this big banquet is going on. And I think the drinking wine and so on is supposed to show this kind of a carefree hilarity. And Babylon is impregnable. Everyone knows that. I mean, that no engine of war in the 6th century B.C. could breach this wall or break down the doors. It's that simple. And with the river Euphrates and the moat and so on. Well, it's kind of like a eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And verse 2, when Belshazzar tasted the wine, he gave orders to bring the gold and silver vessels. This word tasted here has to do with, it means he's been drinking and now suddenly begins to taste the wine. He feels the effects of the wine. He's really getting into the wine. And when a person really gets into the wine, what begins to happen? His reason, his logic begins to escape him, and he starts to give some slurred commands to do something that's going to be very foolish. And now a great idea comes to him. Hey, we can really make a big joke out of this banquet. And he begins to taste the wine and feel the wine. And he said, go get these gold and silver vessels that are in our treasury, which Nebuchadnezzar, his father, really through his mother, Nitocris, his grandfather, but the word father simply means descendant, had taken out of the temple, which was in Jerusalem. And he has these brought for a specific blasphemous purpose. And the purpose is, so that his nobles, his wives, and concubines might drink from them. Frightening business. But this is what wine begins to do. It loosens his tongue, it unhinges his mind, and he begins to give us some commands that he really shouldn't be giving. Now, the history of what is taking place here is interesting. Look back to, you remember now, chapter 1, verse 2, book of Daniel. I think it's fascinating to look at the history of this treasury and of some of the articles that have been taken from the Jews and from Solomon's temple. Daniel 1, verse 2. Last line. And he, Nebuchadnezzar, brought the vessels into the treasury of his God, verse 2 in that verse, along with some of the vessels of the house of God. Now recall that this first invasion by Nebuchadnezzar was just a brief encounter after the Battle of Carchemish in 605 B.C., when he ducked down, took Daniel and a few others, headed back east to Babylon to be crowned king after his father died. And he brought back some of the vessels at that time. It's an interesting study just to look at all these vessels and the treasury that was in Jerusalem. Because remember, the treasury back in those days was like Fort Knox is to us today. It's supposed to represent the national wealth. Let's go back to some earlier things, and you may want to use these verses that we'll look at as a little springboard of study to look at what began to happen in this whole idea of the treasury and everything else. Go back, if you will, to 1 Kings chapter 10, and there are other verses besides these I'm going to give you. But this is just a little sequence, and you can see how the national wealth of Israel began to be built. And it really had its origin first back in the time of David, and I'm sure in the time of the judges before that. But in the time of Solomon, it really began to shape up. And in 1 Kings 10, verse 14. Now, this is at the beginning of Solomon's reign, okay? And Solomon, as you know, became king in 970 B.C., reigned until about 931 B.C. So we're way back here in the 10th century B.C., about 400 years before. Verse 14, now the weight of gold which came into Solomon in 1 year was 666 talents of gold. Now a talent in that time period was about 125 pounds. So 83,250 pounds of gold. And most people agree that back in Solomon's time, 3,000 years ago, you could pick up nuggets off the ground. Occasionally read the paper, you see that happens in Australia. This person was walking across the outback and found a nugget about that size, just a pure gold nugget. And then eventually, as this gold that was on the surface began to disappear, they used to have to mine for it. But now, if you remember, when they discovered King Tut, his sarcophagus was solid gold. It was all eight men could do to lift his solid gold sarcophagus. So, I mean, this is not unusual, because that's how much gold was around back then. So listen to what Solomon does. Besides that, from the traders and the wares and the merchants, verse 16, King Solomon made 200 large shields of beaten gold. And he made 300 shields of beaten gold. Moreover, he made a great throne of ivory, overlaid it with refined gold. Verse 21, all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold. Why, none of them was silver. It was not considered valuable in the days of Solomon. I mean, everything is gold. So this began the national treasury by which the wealth of a nation was determined. Now I'll go over a couple of more chapters to 1 Kings 14. And over the years, this treasury began to be wasted, plundered, used as bribery, and I'm sure replenished a little bit as time went on. Let's go to 1 Kings 14, verse 25. Now it came about in the fifth year of Rehoboam, that Shishak, the king of Egypt, came up against Jerusalem, and he, Rehoboam, took away the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house. He took everything, even taking all the shields of gold which Solomon had made, and he, this king Shishak, the Pharaoh, really, of Egypt, took all these things, and Rehoboam made shields of bronze in their place. Well, we had to give the gold away. Shishak took those. We'll replace them with bronze. No one will know the difference. So things began to be replaced. Now I go to 2 Kings, chapter 16. You see the progress down through time with this treasury here. Chapter 16, 2 Kings, verse 8. And Ahaz, this is the king, took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. So he's using some of the national treasury now to bribe the Assyrian king. And this treasury is diminishing. Okay. Now look on over to Isaiah, and you'll see an event that takes place in Hezekiah's time. Isaiah 39, Hezekiah wants to show off a little bit. Now remember, this is about 95 years before Daniel 1-2. 95 years before Daniel 1-2. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that he had been sick and had recovered. And Hezekiah was pleased and showed them all his treasure house, the silver and the gold and spices and precious oil and his whole armory. So you see, this is a national treasure. And the old Babylonians were taking an inventory. And their inventory probably became part of the national Babylonian archives. And when Nebuchadnezzar came 95 years later, he had his list. And I think I'll take three of these. I'll take four of these and five of these. So this is a quick history of this national treasury, because when an occupying force came in, they simply looted the national treasury like the pirates used to loot. Then that determined the wealth that they had. So this is what began to happen here. So we saw that when Nebuchadnezzar came in 605, this is the event referred to in Daniel chapter 5, that Nebuchadnezzar, his father, had taken. Now, some of the Bibles have a footnote that say 586, and that's not correct. These vessels really came from 605. I'll show you why. Those are the ones that were there in the national treasury. Now, the second invasion, 597, from which Many of the events in Ezekiel are dated that exile of Jehoiakim. Let's look now at 2 Kings chapter 24, and I'll show you what happened to those vessels during the second invasion. 2 Kings 24, verses 12 and 13. And Jehoiakim, the king of Judah, went out to the king of Babylon. Remember, this is 597. He and his mother and his servants and his captains, his officials. So the king of Babylon took him captive in the 8th year of his, that is, the king of Babylon's reign. He was king in 605, the 8th year of his reign, 597. And he carried out from there all the treasures of the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and cut in pieces all the vessels of gold which Solomon, king of Israel, had made in the temple of the Lord. Just as the Lord had said. Cut them up. The ones that were still left around since he'd been there 8 years before. And I'm sure in the meantime, though, they're probably getting gold and they're making new vessels. Okay. But yet, in this invasion, he cut them all up. So it couldn't be this invasion where they had vessels to drink from. Okay. Now, the ones that are left at this time period become part of a prophecy which Jeremiah makes. Maybe a lot goes on around just these vessels. So now go to Jeremiah, Lamentations, Ezekiel again. Jeremiah 27. You know you're going to be so busy with your Bibles this morning. Jeremiah, Lamentation. So Jeremiah 27. I'll read verses 18 through 22. Now this takes place just after the exile of Jehoiakim in 597. You see that because chapter 27 begins verse 1. In the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, and Nebuchadnezzar put Zedekiah on the throne as soon as he took Jehoiakim captive. Okay? This is the end of number 7,